This is KBOO-FM. My name is Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey, and you're listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. If you're in the metro area, it's 90.7. If you are in the Columbia River Gorge, it is 91.9. In the Willamette River Valley, 100.7. And on the web, KBOO.FM.
Joining us today is Professor Michael T. Clear, who is a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and the author of Resource Wars and Blood and Oil. His newest book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy, has just been published by Metropolitan Books. Professor Clear joins us today to take a New Year's look deep into the future, taking up the fate of China, the United States, the global South, and nothing short of a planet ready to strike back by 2020. His recent article, The Second Decade, The World in 2020, has been published by Tom Dispatch by Com, and it is linked to our website here at KBOO-FM. Professor Clear, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Professor Clear. How are you doing?
Good morning, Celeste. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Cecil and
good.
I are here to welcome you to Portland. I understand you passed through here. I believe it was it the summer or the fall?
Oh, I think it was a fall a year ago.
Right.
And it was just a delight, and I understand that you broadcast in the Columbia River Gorge, and I drove through there on my way to Walla Walla, and it was just a spectacular drive, so for the people listening there, I just envy you to live in such a beautiful area.
Well, we're hoping that the planet sees fit to keep it so.
Well, recently you've written a lot, but we saw a recent article of yours that we wanted to begin our conversation about, and that was an article that was published in Tom Dispatch, The Second Decade, The World in 2020. And in this article, you take an examination of where we are today and look at the future, particularly what will happen within the next decade. And in this, you outline several things that are currently happening and give us some guidelines and some suggestions of where we are headed as a world. So perhaps we can begin by talking about the article, The Second Decade, The World in 2020, and in it you outline four aspects in it, and the rise of China, the decline of the U.S., the expanding role of the global South, and the increase in impact of a planet that wants to fight back. Could you tell us something about the origins of this article or why you wrote it at this time?
Hello, I hope you can hear me, but I lost you.
Okay. I'll try to recap there for Cecil. We wanted to talk about that most recent article of yours, The Second Decade, The World
in
2020.
Yes, I heard that. And what was the question, Celeste?
Well, basically, to recap the four elements that you outlined, the four trends that you had mentioned that will dominate the second decade of this century, and we talked about the descending eagle, as you put it, or the decline of the U.S. as the world power, especially economically and politically, the rise of China, the rise of the global South as well, and especially as those who are the keeper of many of the remaining world resources, and then the planetary blowback that we're experiencing.
Right. Well, now these are, you know, of all the things that we might see in the coming decade, the second decade of the 21st century, these are the four developments that I see as the dominant ones. And some, the rise of China, I think nobody could question anymore that China has become one of the world's great powers. And this really accelerated, I think, in 2009 during the economic crisis, because China suffered the least of any of the great powers in the crisis. It didn't go into recession. Its growth slowed down a bit, but it didn't go into recession. And now it's on its way back to very high growth. So it's really jumped ahead. It China is now the world's leading exporter. It overtook Germany to be the world's number one exporter of goods in December, and it's on its way to overtake Japan to be the world's number two economy after the United States in 2010. So there's no escaping the fact that China is going to loom very large on the horizon in the coming decade and beyond. That's the first thing that I think we all have to deal with.
How you mentioned almost in passing how China avoided the economic crisis in 2009. How did they avoid that?
They didn't avoid it entirely. They did see a slowdown in growth, but they adopted an economic stimulus package the way we did, almost as big as ours. Ours is $787 billion. Theirs was $586 billion. So it's a little smaller, but they were much more efficient in getting the money out into the economy, much faster than ours. We've only gotten, I think, about a quarter of the stimulus money out into pockets of people in this country, but they've gotten their money out much faster, and they're putting it much more efficiently into infrastructure that will benefit the economy. New railroads, ports, harbors, airports, and transmission lines, high efficiency, electrical grid, investment in green technology, so that their stimulus package will give them much more leverage in terms of the future efficiency of their economy, whereas our stimulus package is mainly going to avert the collapse of states, school systems, police systems, and the like, because our states are hurting so badly. So this was a stopgap measure, but it isn't doing very much to ensure long-term economic growth. So that's a big difference.
There are some folks who think that China's stimulus package had too much, overstimulation in it. And I do want to come back to that and discuss that in terms of our future options. But we would like to move on a little bit to some of the other issues, such as the rising global south, and talk about why that is significant. As the nations and sovereign areas that have most of the resources that a lot of the global north and more industrialized, quote-unquote, mature countries need, they're going to be much more significant than they ever have been. And you mentioned some reasons why we should be paying attention to them.
Yes, I think this is probably going to be one of the most striking features of this second decade, is the growing importance of the global south, Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and so on. Now, we've known for a long time that the global south was important, but I think it's going to become much more important. Now, partly this is just due to numbers. The south is growing in population much faster than the rest of the world. It also harbors a much larger share of the world's remaining resources. Now, we in the north, like in the United States and North America, were once the leading producers of key resources like iron and copper and oil, most of all. The U.S. was once the world's leading oil producer, but we've used up most of our resource inheritance. The same is true of Europe and Russia and China. So from now on, we in the North, the industrial countries, are going to be heavily dependent on the global South for our resources. And we, in the past, in the imperial era, we just went in there and took what we wanted. That's what imperialism was all about. And we're not going to be able to do that anymore. We're going to have to bargain with these countries, and they're becoming increasingly determined to control their own resources. That's what Hugo Chavez about Venezuela is about, and the royal family in Saudi Arabia, and the government of South Africa, and so on. They're all different, and we may not like the way they're behaving, but this is a consistent pattern as the Global South is forcing us to deal on their terms when acquiring resources. We're going to have to pay a lot more for it, and that's going to have a huge impact on our economy.
We're not only paying more for it, but we're competing with other established countries as well as the emerging countries.
You put your finger on it. Exactly right. We will have to compete with China and Europe and Japan and India before long for what's left of the world's vital resources, oil, natural gas, uranium, copper, and everything else we need. So the prices will rise, and we're going to see a new kind of global politics. We see that every day, where the Chinese, for example, go out, send their leaders to Africa all the time to nurture ties with the African government so that they get a better deal in this competition. We're not used to behaving that way, and we're going to suffer as a result if we don't change our behavior and view the South in a more equitable fashion.
We're speaking this morning with Michael Clear, who is the professor of peace at Hampshire College and the author of numerous books. His recent article, The Blowback Effect 2020, has been published on TomDispatch.com. I was wondering, Professor Clear, as you mentioned the developments, if we could touch upon the other two points that you mentioned before we go in depth and examination. Related to the rise of China and the importance of the Global South, you also touch upon what many people are experiencing, at least intellectually, the decline, the relative decline of the U.S. Is that something that, how would you describe the decline of the U.S. in the next decade?
Well, Cecil, you use the right word. It's the relative decline, and I think it's important to underscore that. The United States is not getting weaker in absolute terms. Our military is still all-powerful compared to other countries. But other countries like China, India, and Brazil are getting much stronger than they ever were before. So our capacity, the capacity of the United States to dictate to other countries around the world to set the global agenda, is diminishing. We can no longer tell other countries what we want them to do in a way that we've been accustomed to since the end of World War II. We're going to have to bargain much more with other countries, and that means sometimes we're not going to get our way. And we've seen this in President Obama's trip to China, when the Chinese dictated the economic terms because they're so much more resilient now economically, and at the Copenhagen Climate Summit, when the Chinese also dictated terms and we weren't able to override them. This is the pattern increasingly we're going to face, where the United States is outvoted in international arenas, and we can't overturn these decisions because we're not as powerful as we once were.
And I'll hold up on following up on that.
And then we wanted to look at the last point that you had mentioned, and that was the blowback effect, the planetary blowback. As you mentioned, we're used to thinking of blowback in terms of political response, but we're looking at now a natural response. And so if you could touch upon that.
Yes. Well, blowback is a term often used to speak about when political or military ventures trigger unintended effects. You start a war and it triggers a backlash you didn't anticipate, like the U.S. war in Iraq created anti-Americanism around the world because of our unilateral intervention there, for example. So I believe we're seeing the same thing with the planet, with our overconsumption of resources and our excessive emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the planet is responding. You know, you almost think of it as having a consciousness. Of course, it doesn't have that, but it seems that way because the planet is responding to our careless behavior by responding with more intense hurricanes, more frequent hurricanes, by droughts around the world, by water shortages. We saw this in the first decade of the 21st century. I think it's going to get a lot worse in the second decade of the 21st century. Now, many of your listeners may have seen the movie Avatar, which I happened to see with my son over the holidays. And in that movie, the planet does have a kind of a consciousness, and it does strike back at what we can assume is a multinational corporation which invades the planet Pandora to gobble up its resources. I don't think that's quite happening on this planet, but it's something along those lines.
All right. Right. We're speaking this morning with Michael T. Clear, who is the Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College, the author of books including Resource Wars, and his most recent book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. We invite you to be a part of our conversation. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187, or you may email us at moretalkradio@gmail. As you outline what will happen within the next decade and how things will change, many people are worried about the rise of China and the relative decline of the United States. I want to talk a little bit more about China initially in terms of China's self-understanding of its power and how it uses its power. You mentioned in part China continued to expand its economy, but its use of military force seems to be a bit different than the U.S., is that correct?
Well, up until now, you know, China has been very restrained in its behavior. You know, if you look at the Pacific Ocean and the Western Pacific, the United States is the dominant military power in that region, not China. And you think of Taiwan, which the Chinese think of as a renegade province. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. is still supporting Taiwan militarily, and we have bases throughout the region. So even though China has become our near equal in economic terms, in military terms, it's not. And so it has been very restrained in its use of military power. But I think that could change.
Well, Professor Clair, let me ask something as you're expanding on that. Is one reason possibly the fact that it could be that China has recognized that would be a detour, an unnecessary detour in their economic growth and pursuit of their ultimate goals, because it can see how military encounters have bankrupted the United States?
Well, Celeste, I think you're right about that. I think that they spend a much smaller share of their GDP on the military than we do, and that means they have more money to invest in other things. China spends about 2% of its GDP on the military. We spend about 4%, so that's one reason. I think another reason is that they don't want to frighten their neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Their neighbors in Indonesia, Thailand, Japan, South Korea, and so on, are worried enough as it is about China's economic growth. So I think they don't want to make those countries fearful of China's military growth and then, you know, create arms races and military alliances and the like that would damage their economic ties with those countries. So I think it's a very pragmatic strategy of avoiding confrontation.
Well, as well as the fact that they also used money saved to, shall we say, lubricate some of their diplomatic encounters and overtures.
Well, absolutely. I mean, they come across as being a friendly, safe, unthreatening country. But we do see signs that that's beginning to change in small ways. There's more Chinese arms sales abroad than ever before. They're sending military advisors to more countries. So there is an increase in China's military diplomacy, and I think we'll see more of that in the future, especially in Central Asia, in the SANs, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and so forth, as those countries become more important to China as a source of energy.
We're speaking this morning with Professor Michael T. Clare, who is the author of a recent article, The Blowback Effect 2020. In it, he talks about his view of what changes will come about within the next decade and perhaps our response to these changes. Give us a call at 503-231-8187. We have a caller online, and we'll go to our next caller. Jeff, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Cecil. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, Celeste. This program is fabulous. And Professor Clare, thank you so much for these explanations. I wanted to draw attention to the African connections. And then I have a question, if you'll allow me.
Yes.
Well, already, by the way, China is busily expanding its military budget to a pretty robust degree for what it has, which is small in comparison to our own. And remember that they were sending warships. The Chinese government sent warships, even fired on a pirate vessel, but sent warships to patrol the Gulf of Aden off of Somalia. That leads me to the African connections with China. And my question relates to basic governmental style and what about human rights? Because when the Chinese government comes into, say, Democratic Republic of Congo, or I guess they're more occupied in other parts of the continent, but when they come in and they craft a deal and so forth and extract resources and pay, sure, in cash, but their attitude about human rights, about political rights, is pretty abjectly poor. Their history is so bad. I remember Tiananmen Square. I think a lot of us do. And it hasn't gotten a whole lot better. And to what extent, then, will this money diplomacy in this global south, especially in resource-rich Africa, to what extent will it lessen the global, the Western interest in the idea of political and human rights as a universal, and will it dilute the message of human rights on a political level around the world? And I hope you understand my question.
Well, sure. Thanks for your comments, Jeff. And
I'll take your answer off the air then. Thank you.
I will say two things about that. First of all, you're absolutely right that China is becoming increasingly active in Africa in the pursuit of resources. In the Congo, as you mentioned, and Angola, Nigeria, and Sudan, Zimbabwe. And its policy is universally the same, and they say this quite publicly, is we're here to do business, not to engage in the domestic politics of countries. So they do not condemn the bad human rights behavior of the governments they deal with. So in that sense, you're quite right that they ignore human rights abuses. It's especially so in Sudan, where the government is, notoriously involved in terrible abuses in Darfur, and in Zimbabwe, where the government leader Robert Mugabe is engaged in terrible behaviors, and the Chinese are among the leading supporters of both governments. That said, the history of Western governments in Africa is not much better. And to say that, the West or the United States has been a paragon of virtue in promoting human rights in Africa and our pursuit of resources would be you know, a real exaggeration. The U.S. is, for example, providing a lot of support to the Nigerian government, which is using American aid to suppress the insurgency in the Niger Delta, where people have been terribly messed over by the oil companies, environmentally and otherwise, as Nigeria, the government there absorbs all the wealth from oil production, and none of it goes to the benefit of the people of the Niger Delta, and the U.S. is implicated in that. So I think the behavior of all outside powers in the pursuit of resources in Africa is terrible.
We're speaking with Professor Michael T. Clare, who in a recent article, The Blowback Effect, looks at the rise of China, the relative decline of the U.S., the expanding role of the global south, and climate change and growing resource scarcity. We invite you to be a part of this conversation, 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning. Thank you for waiting.
Yes, hello, Professor. How do we get our federal government to pay back our whatever it's called money debt to China? And also, are you a professor of peace or teach peace issues?
Well, thank you for your question. My title is Peace and World Security Studies. So
my first question, but the second one, if you want to answer it too, what is peace to you? And is peace really?
Well, Carla, we're actually looking at something slightly different. If you could have them expand on your first point first.
Well, I'll do both because they're both related. You know, my title is Peace and World Security Studies, and my concern is what are the forces and trends in the world that make the world more unstable and dangerous and that lead to conflict and violence, and how can we prevent that? So I'm always looking at the trends, like the ones we've been discussing this morning, that might make the world more unstable. Now, the caller asked about our very great indebtedness to China.
Yes.
And this is a big worry. China is now our biggest debtor. We owe more money to China than any other foreign government. And we continue to rely on China. We'll continue to rely on China because of continued budget deficits. And this is one of the primary sources of America's decline. You can't be a great world power and exercise great power in the world when you're in debt and when your debt is growing and when another country holds a large part of your debt. This is a tremendous strategic weakness. And the question is, what will China do with its debt? We don't have the money to pay them back. Their money is held in dollars. And dollars are becoming of diminishing value, let's put it that way. I was going to say worthless. They're not worthless, but of diminishing value, and there's signs that the Chinese want to dump some of them. What they are doing with them is buying up resource properties around the world, oil fields, mines, everywhere. And this is also contributing to the shift in power from the U.S. to China. It's a deeply disturbing trend, and the caller is right to call our attention to this.
You're listening to More Talk Radio. This is your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. If you want to join in the conversation with Professor Clare as we discuss his article, The Second Decade, you may call at 503-231-8187 and join in the conversation, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. I got a couple of questions for the professor. The first one is a comment is that the downfall of capitalism is that everything in America is for sale. That's one of the downfalls of America. But in terms of the relative decline of America, I think Well, let me back up. How does the fact that foreign countries own a lot of the American economy, and in fact, most American jobs and everything else is being shipped to other countries, how does that play into the relative decline of America? And my second question, you mentioned something about Japan. Well, since America dropped an atomic bomb on Japan, they occupied it, they resurrected it, an American image. And so is in fact, Japan really an American economy? Those are my two questions.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, well, my golly, that would make an interesting morning conversation,
yes.
All of that, and probably couldn't do justice to all of it. But let's look at the first question. What's happening here is true. The caller said that we're losing jobs to China, and they are acquiring properties around the world. This is part of the shift in economic power from the U.S. to China. Now, the question really that should be asked is, what should be done about this? How can we address this shift in power? Is the Congress and the administration doing everything it can to address our structural problems? And I would say that it's not. I would say that there's more we could do to address these problems. I think, for example, personally, that we're spending too much on the military. And Celeste, you alluded to this earlier. We now spend seven times as much as China on the military, $600-odd billion to their $85 billion, and I think that's not an advantage to us, but a disadvantage to us. Maybe some people in the audience will think differently, but I think that that allows them to devote more money to their infrastructure development and education and science, while we're losing in the education and the science race. So I think we should shift our priorities. Let's see what other people think.
Yeah. Well, just to expand on that, you mentioned that the U.S., the amount of resources U.S. use in its military, I mean, I would suspect both China and the U.S. Both want to be the dominant power. Apparently, the U.S. has used its economic might and military might in the past to push its agenda. China, it seems to be taking a different tact, at least initially. Is it possible for the U.S. To maintain its dominance? You mentioned that the GDP in 2020 will be one-third greater than it is today. Will it be possible for the U.S. to maintain its dominance without decreasing its military?
I don't see how the United States can remain a robust economy with the way things are today. And I know that there's a big debate about this, and other people listening will have different views. But, for example, that the Chinese government is much tougher on lending practices than our government is. The reason why we had an economic crisis is because of lax government oversight of the big banks and financial organizations, and they were allowed to invent these very exotic derivatives and all of this. I still don't understand them, to be perfectly honest, but we know that their wealth, their value evaporated, and it took down the American economy. Well, that didn't happen in China because the government has much stricter oversight of the banks. I think we need tighter regulation in this country, for example. I think we also need to invest more money in science and education and technology than we do. The Chinese are investing vast sums in creating new high-tech universities and improving their public education so that they will be on the forefront of technology, especially green technology, the technology of the future, than we are. High-speed trains. high-speed grid. We're falling behind in those technologies, and that means we'll be further behind 10 years from now and 20 years from now than we are today. So that's where I think we need to see a shift in priorities.
I do have a question, though. Now, one of the things that I had did a little checking on with regard to China's growth is the fact that while they have increased the or maintained, rather, I should say, their production levels, one of the reasons they were able to maintain the production levels was the fact that, yes, they did pump more of their stimulus package into domestic infrastructure reinforcement, but it was also by pumping up their domestic consumption of goods and products that were produced. Now, I'm thinking, first, you've got a country wherein the people don't make a lot of money, so when you are basing part of your economic recovery, and I'm going to put that in quotation marks, on increased domestic consumption, who's paying for these goods and how are they paying for them? And then there's claims that also China's economic recovery is also fueled by an increased amount of money put in real estate, and that perhaps that is another bubble that's being created. So I'm looking at the fact that folks such as James Chanos, who is called the contrarian investor, thinks that China's headed for a crash. Now, I'm not necessarily asking you to comment on how valid Chanos' thoughts are, but more of if the growth that China has is not sustainable. Yes, they have put some in green industry, as you said, in transportation. But if their growth is not sustainable, where does that leave all of us in the long run when they are becoming the economic lead of this planet?
Well, again, those are important big questions and hard for one person to answer, and I think there may be some real basis for concern in what you say, Celeste, especially about the real estate bubble in China. I don't know enough to say whether that's a real danger or not. But one difference between China and the United States is they have a much higher savings rate than we do.
That is so true.
Yes. I mean, our citizens are terribly in debt. Sure, I don't have to talk about my credit card debt, but, you know, we're all pretty much in that boat. You don't have that in China. So you don't have the ripple effect where, you know, when a bank goes down or the mortgage foreclosures happen, that you have the ripple effect because so many people are in debt. People have savings in China, so they have a cushion. And they have the money to spend because they've been saving it. So there is a big difference there. We're just now in this country learning to be thrifty and to save money. But our debt is so monumental, it's going to take us a long time to get in a stable place.
Our debt is monumental, but you know something that's ironic is the Chinese are our debtors. You know, we owe so much money to them.
Yes.
And just recently, they chastised us for spending so much, for buying so much, yet they're counting on us to be consumers to keep their export levels as high as they are.
Yes, they do. That's partly why they lend us this money, because that's a way of keeping interest rates low, so that we'll go on spending money and buying their goods. It's a self-perpetuating system that they are engaged in.
Which makes me feel that this might ultimately be type of a shell game, in that it's not really that their growth has been stimulated, but maybe hyper-stimulated or pseudo-stimulated, because it's a matter of robbing Peter to pay Paul to pay John, you know, to pay Ringo, you know, and basically you've just got money moving but no substance to it.
Well, there is signs that China is attempting to deal with that by opening up markets, not just in the United States, but around the world, you know, that they're opening up markets in Southeast Asia and Japan and Europe and Africa and Latin America, diversifying their economy. So I think they're aware of this. I think you're right. It's a problem. But I think they are taking steps to diminish their very heavy dependence on the American market.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Michael T. Clare, who is the author of Blood and Oil and Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on the OMO Variety Hour, Steve Novick talks with Bill Resnick about why taxing the rich is really good for the economy, civic life, and ordinary people. A discussion of local small-scale renewable energy, and the movie moles look at the cultural politics of the blockbuster movie Avatar. At 10 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein asks, what's up with the Portland water? Does Portland need to cover its reservoirs? Guests are David Schaff with the Portland Water Bureau, and Floyd Jones and Scott Fernandez are friends of the reservoir. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dr. Peter D'Amo, author of Eat Right for Your Type. They discuss his latest book, Change Your Genetic Destiny. And at 11:30, hear a special version of It Takes a Village. Host Shamid Hamid speaks with Eric Martin of the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon about ballot measures 66 and 67. All of this here on your community radio station, KBOO. Presently, we're speaking with Michael Clare, and we will go to our next caller. Thank you for waiting. Good morning, Brian.
God, I thought I'd almost forgotten what I was going to ask. Anyway, Prof, I've lived all over South and Central America and darker times, and I wonder if I've got three questions, and I'll keep it brief and then listen to the answers on the air. First off, do you see the U.S. dropping this ludicrous embargo on Cuba it's had for so long, led by the rising economies in South and Central America, although I know Chavez just devalued their currency? Second, do you see this is just one of my crazy theories, but do you see a universal South and Central American currency, kind of like the euro, happening? I mean, it seems like Banco del Sur is headed this way. And third, in a totally different part of the world, if the U.S. is talking about withdrawing from Iraq, why the hell are they building the biggest embassy in the world there? Thank you, and I'll take my answers off the air.
Those are interesting questions. I'm afraid I don't know enough about Central America to answer the question about the currency.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that the U.S. is going to end the embargo on Cuba anytime soon, not under present political circumstances. I don't see it. Now, the question about Iraq, now that's a more interesting one. I don't see that the United States is withdrawing from Iraq at all. I just think that there'll be a sharp reduction in the number of American combat forces. You always have to stick in that word combat in the combat forces, because a large number of American soldiers will remain in Iraq to provide training, protection, intelligence operations, to run the airports, and a whole lot more. So we're not going to see a withdrawal of American forces from Iraq for a very, very long time, not in any foreseeable future.
Well, this is news that we all need to know and reflect upon. And I was wondering, speaking of Iraq and related issues, we need to touch upon renewable energy and climate change and reflection on Copenhagen.
As well as whatever cooperative strategies we need to adopt politically and economically for survival.
Yes.
So looking at 2020, as we see the planet begin to change and respond back to what we're doing, what do you think the U.S. and other governments should do to meet the challenges we face? It seems as if what happened in Copenhagen was not a success.
No, I don't think Copenhagen was a success. I don't think it was a total failure either. It was somewhere in between. I give President Obama credit for finding a interim step which allows for continuing talks and for some measure of cooperation in the hope that something better will emerge from future negotiations. But in response to your question, what do we need? I think what we need is a new web of international agreements and structures, some of them under the United Nations, probably some of them outside the United Nations, that involve the not only the older powers, the United States and Europe and so on, but also the rising powers, China and India and Brazil, in arrangements to address particular problems. I'll give you an example. At the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, this is the leaders of the top 20 world economies. At this meeting, the G7, that's the richest countries in the world, the global north, agreed to form an alliance, as it were, with the global south, with the rising stars of the global south, to take over oversight of the world economy and to make the G20 now be the overseer body for the world economy. That was a step forward. That's saying that the rich countries can no longer run things by themselves. We have to have a new architecture, a new structure to address the world economy. We have to do that in every area, in the environment, in all forms of politics that you could imagine. We have to have new constellations of power that involve countries which were excluded from decision making before. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't perceive what this architecture might look like, but that's the way we have to go. The United States can't look down from on high and say, well, all you lowly countries have to do our bidding. We have to sit at a bargaining table with these other countries like China and India and Brazil and so forth and work out arrangements for our mutual benefit. And that's going to be a new challenge.
Well, it seems like it will be a new challenge and a shift in the attitude of the United States. One thing that I remember from Copenhagen is a scene, in my mind at least, is the President of the United States sort of like knocking on the door and forcing himself into a room where I think it was Brazil and China and maybe other countries were involved in negotiation, and it was for me at least a picture of a shifting forces of power
and alliances.
That's the word I was looking for. Mm-hmm. Do you think the United States is able to sit around the table with other countries as partners and try not to be the dominant force?
You know, that depends on our leadership, Cecil. I think that President Obama has that capacity. He has said that he's willing to do that, and he has shown by his behavior that he's able to do it. I don't think that President Bush had that capacity, and some of our other some of their predecessors, they just had the hubris, the arrogance that, you know, we're number one and that's the way it has to be.
And, so, you know, not only the hubris, but, you know, just as you said, just not having the backing or the prodding of the people as well. We've personally, I think a lot of us have had some epiphanies and some shifts. But I want to sum it up to go back to the last part of your article, in which you look at the whole experience we have relative to the movie Avatar and their pursuit of a very valuable mineral, which had an interesting name, which I put the proper stress on to get my point, unobtainium.
Yeah.
When will we recognize that there's certain behaviors that are going to put our well-being in an unobtainable place if we don't have those emotional and mental and ethical shifts?
Oh, that's the big question of this century.
That's right.
That's the big one. And, you know, I think people are beginning to understand how important it is. I don't think they're there yet. I mean, you do see people are making individual choices. Each time somebody goes out and buys a Prius or another or hybrid car, an electric car, or weatherizes their house or buys solar panels, they're making an individual decision to change their behavior. We have to make many, many, many more decisions like that before we'll really overcome the behaviors that lead to that kind of murderous behavior you see in Avatar, and that goes on every day in Africa and in Latin America. But that's the path we have to go down.
That path and the path of cooperation and learning that we're no longer preeminent but one of the group.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Claire, for joining us this morning. I want to thank you for sharing your time and remind our listeners that you can read his books, Resource Wars, Blood and Oil, and Rising Powers and Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. There is a link to his article, The Second Decade, The World in 2020, on our website. And thank you for joining us this morning.
I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.